Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi.
Siri. Welcome to High Theory.
In this podcast, we get high on the substance of theory.
I'm Sharunik Boshu.
And I'm Kim Adams.
We are two tired academics trying to save critique from itself.
So today, I'm talking with Mackenzie Cooley about The Animal, or animals. Mackenzie, can I ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. Hello, everybody. My name is Mackenzie Cooley. I'm a professor here at Hamilton College in upstate New York, and I teach a lot on intellectual history, more broadly the history of ideas, what ideas have gotten people up in the morning, what genius means, and I'm really interested in the interaction between Europe and regions that we've considered Latin America. So I particularly look at Italian, Spanish imperial entanglements.
Cool. Mackenzie has a new book out that is called The Perfection of Nature. It's a book about the history of animal breeding and the concept of race in the early modern period. And so we have asked her here today to answer for us, what the heck is an animal?
Oh, what a great question. An animal is all of us, and animals are everywhere we look in our own behavior that seems to both be rational and be beyond reason, but also non-human animals surround us, right? So they're on our plates, they're part of our clothes, they are in the fields that we pass by, they're on our leashes as we walk down the street. And I think that as members of a modern world and a modern society, we have gotten ourselves kind of deluded and kind of alienated from the animal that's in all of us and the ways in which animal studies, animal history, animal impulses explain much of who we are and what we do, but also have been used to shape what has been seen as the highest echelons of human art and artifice and science and culture. The animal then is central to the creation of science itself.
Yeah, the creation of science and the creation of the human, or the concept of the human, I would say.
And it's so interesting when in the historical record we start to see traces of that term human, or that distinction between human and more than human. And very often, you know, it comes in a lot of Christian discourse. Of course, Jose de Acosta and his famous Natural History of the Indies, read all over Europe by the time we get to 1600. He's really careful to differentiate what was supposed to happen in terms of human migration, because humans can be perfectible, they can become godly. And really non-human animal migration. So for instance, why are there camelids? Camelids seem, or llamas and alpacas, especially of the Andes, seem really different than European sheep, huh? And also not present in other places. So very often in these Christian documents, you see an attentive disambiguation of the human from the animal. But most people who handled animals on a daily basis, and we even see this in ourselves and those of us who have pets and stuff, tend to be a little bit more amorphous about those differences. Often they percolate one into the other. And, you know, can you really say that your pet isn't a member of your family? Then I think that those boundaries are perhaps easier to cross.
Yeah, and messier. Let me ask you our second question. How do I use an animal?
You use an animal to make sense of who you are, to develop those fundamental metaphors that center yourself as a rational actor, but also yourself as like a living, breathing beast. The history of science is really based on a dynamic relationship between a focus on the human body, human health, human medicine, and comparative anatomy, an attention to how the human fits into other types of life, of living, of bodies, right? So we are constantly engaged in a comparative project. And so as soon as we start to think about who we are, what makes us special, what makes human consciousness so unique, what makes human intelligence so defined, we start meandering down the slippery slope of distinctions into other really exceptional species. So historically, I think the animal is whatever you use to think slightly beyond yourself and to then turn into what constitutes your uniqueness in the first place. It's a space for exceptionalism. And perhaps a realization that all of nature is more alike than we might want to think.
That all of nature is more alike than we might want to think.
Human rationality and human intentionality is not always separated. There's a lot of space in which animals can have some semblance of control over their own lives.
Okay. Can you tell me what are the ways in which animals have control over their own lives?
One of the sections of the book that I love the most has this description of the windmare.
Okay.
The windmare is a really classical trope. If you go back to Virgil, and the early moderns thought this explained a lot about some of the wily things that were going on with their horses.
Okay.
The windmare is a female horse.
Mm-hmm.
And as if is this horse who becomes so lusty for the west wind,
okay,
that she ultimately conceives entirely on her own. There's no one in the field out there with her. It's just her and her own imagination, right?
Okay.
So breeders of these animals, again, these popularizers of the term race, were actually really interested in animal imagination.
Mm-hmm.
They were worried about wind and what might happen out in the field, but also what ugly images might do to the offspring born in the stables, right? Would that make the new generation of animal stock uglier or different, right? Because they were seeing themselves as a part of ugliness rather than as a result of beauty. And that is, in the Renaissance kind of vision, part of the animal mind, the animal imagination, that if a really clever breeder would have to take seriously and then mitigate and control in order to create the what they would see as the best results.
Because their goal is to create beautiful horses, say.
Their goal would be to create a more perfect version of nature.
So much like the Wunderkamera, the like collecting of the wonders of nature, the project of these breeders is the perfection of nature, as the title of your book suggests. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's cool, right? Because it's ultimately, I think that in the history of science, we've thought a lot about, frankly, dead nature stuff.
Mm.
Like how a whole variety, how great diversity can be preserved, pasted together, and transformed into a new image. By contrast, I am really interested in the politics of life making. I'm really interested in living animals. And the fact that those were both living collections, a stable could be read as a living cabinet of curiosities in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But those animals were also intentionally improved and were themselves sometimes seen as participating in that intentional improvement.
Okay. So then maybe on this question of the politics of creating life,
yeah,
let me ask you our final question, which is, how will animals save the world?
How will animals save the world? Well, I mean, insofar as the world is going to be saved, they have to. Because we are, of course, animals operating in our potential. But
yeah.
I think that animals will save the world by taking seriously what I was saying earlier. We're all more a bit alike than different, right? I really admire the recent turns in the NSF's funding, for instance, to take more seriously Indigenous science and include a more radically open understanding of kinship to see how a squirrel is a being that can be kin, right? Versus something that is always, always separate, always bestial, never accessible. And I think that if we are really going to take our environmental precarity seriously, we need that expanded network of what constitutes kin. But also on the kind of dangerous side, how do animals put the world at risk, right?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that Genocide Watch is organizations that are watching for the behaviors that could kind of become genocidal. One of the things that people look for are terms of bestialization, right? Not taking others as seriously human. And in those moments of danger, you have a kind of winnowing down of potential membership in a society.
Mm.
So animals would save the world by forcing us into this expanded, explosive, porous openness to other ways of being.
Yeah, both acknowledging that we are animals is a way of expanding our thought in order to deal with the disaster, the many disasters that await us, but it's also as a sort of rhetorical structure in human society, it's often a sign that we're contracting our thought and that we're shrinking down the category of who matters.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, even in this like history of entanglement, right, between the animal distinctions of race, or we would say today breed or species. And in English today, we use really different terms to talk about ethnic difference. On one hand, our modern differentiators of race are really powerful, right? Insofar as they've made it possible for people of all different sorts of backgrounds to claim place and to organize. That's huge, right? And so insofar as race is a helpful concept, that's great. But it also kind of goes to show that I think we're going to get ourselves into trouble if we start to think of humans as fundamentally exceptional. If you learn nothing else about by studying the American and European encounter over especially the early 16th century, it's that there are many, many living organisms and many elements of living nature who were all motivated by some semblance of competition, a desire to survive, and continued on because they were either lucky or wily enough to carve out a place for themselves, right? And in this way, humans act as both conquistadors, but also organisms that are desirous of conquest.
Yeah. Actually, one of the passages I remember most strongly from your book was the dogs of war that the Spanish used.
I'm delighted that you gauged for that passage. And I think that for the Spanish, some of the dogs they brought with them were, of course, meant to be weapons. They were meant to be tools of destruction and control. But many of the other dogs that came were also herding dogs, some even early dogs that were related in some way or another to German shepherds, right? And so what you find in the first generations of Spanish presence in the Americas is this love story, actually, between indigenous American dogs, like the Chaloitz Quintly, which had, of course, been carefully bred for generations by indigenous Mexicans, who, just like many different humans, right, found a lover in someone from across the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the result of that is actually this shocking mestizaje, this mixing, a term that we normally use in English to describe ethnic categories in Mexico for humans, right, was actually readily used to describe this process of mixing, interplay, and the resultant offspring, the resultant children from seemingly different populations that could then once again be like multiple tributaries feeding a river flow together.
I like that idea of the dogs finding a lover from across the ocean.
Really? No.
We probably will cut this. So let me ask you, do you have a dog?
Do I have a dog? Yeah, I do have, I have two dogs.
Yeah.
I have become a lover of the Newfoundlands. Yeah. And so we have a whole string of dogs that have been named out of Italian history books. So there's Cosimo de' Medici. And there was Lucrezia Borgia. Sadly, we lost Lucrezia. And now there's named for the Ursulines, Little Bear, or Ursula.
Nice. Nice. I also have a Newfoundland.
No, you don't.
Yeah, I do.
No, you don't. You should keep this in.
Yeah, his name is not really anywhere near as delightful, though. He came from a dog breeder, so he has a like show kennel name, which is Paramount Bowwaters Tag Me In at Darbydale.
I love it. I love it. What a highfalutin Paramount presence.
Yeah.
I love this so much. Indeed. So Ursula, our recent Newfie, our recent addition in Newfoundland, came from a breeder, and I was really not least kind of interested in going through that process because of having written this book.
Yeah.
And the breeder is called, I kid you not, Swamp Trailer Newfies. And so in every one of her formal AKC names, it's Harley Orange Girl, whatever they had, of the Swamp Trailer Newfies. And if we were to rename her, we had to keep Swamp Trailer Newfies. Swamp Trailer all the way down.
Ursula of the Swamp Trailer Newfies.
That's right. That's who we have.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, Mackenzie, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about the animal and about your wonderful animals.
I'm so delighted to get to be here and to share this work with you, to think with you, and the sense of play that you bake into these conversations is really a pleasure.
Aw, thank you.
And thank you for listening to High Theory.
If you like our podcast, please review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast fix.
Owen Quinn composes our theme music, Sharonic Bosu and Kim Adams edit our audio, and Sharonic Bosu manages our social media.
You can find High Theory on the New Books Network and also on hightheory.net.
We hope you have a highly theoretical day.